I do remember my aunt was my favorite aunt, was a nurse, and she took me one day to the hospital where she worked, and she said to all the ones over there, she wants to be a doctor, and they left the room, I'm sure, with a smirk in their face. I wish I remember their names now, but you know, it's almost like never doubt that someone can make it possible if they really are committed to doing it. And I was always committed.
That is Dr. Antonia Novello. Not only did Antonia become a doctor, in 1990, she made history as the first female and first Hispanic U.S. Surgeon General.
My husband-to-be told me at that time, I said, I would love to be a surgeon. And he says, let's put it this way. Do you want to be a married pediatrician or a single surgeon? Of course, I am a pediatrician. But then God comes and makes me the Surgeon General of the United States, which I have not let him forget.
This is Finding Humanity, and I'm your host, Hazami Bermada. Through true stories of courage and purpose, we put a human face on the biggest challenges of our time. This season, we will focus on how women's excellence shapes history. In each episode, we bring you powerful voices of women sharing challenges that they had to overcome across different fields and cultures, and their journey to achieving greatness. Antonia was born in a small town in Puerto Rico. Both of her parents worked in public service, her father as a police officer and her mother as a school teacher.
My mother always suggested that education was the way out of everything, and then she pushed. Through my life, then she became the principal of the school where I was, and then she pushed even harder. She was very empathetic, but not sympathetic, for which reason she always pushed, but with the hope of getting me to be somebody without making me feel that I was not able to get to the top.
Antonia dreamed of becoming a doctor at a time when women weren't expected to do so. She looked up to the doctors who treated the disorder of the large intestine that she was born with. Every summer as a child, she spent a couple of weeks at the hospital.
I always wanted to be a doctor because of the time I spent in hospitals. I never verbalized it. Afraid of failure. A little town in where everybody knows you and your mother, you're not going to give your mother anything that is failure from the daughter that she expects so much. So I never said, but I went and took all the sciences and all the things that was important. And it was really interesting. In my class in high school, mother said, you're going to college now because you only have one class missing of your senior year. So take it in the summer and you go. I say, mommy, I'm only 14 going in 15. I will have no friends. I don't want to do this. It will separate me. I feel too young, too immature to go to college. And so mommy says, well, let's get it this way. You're going to take the test to go to college right now. In this year, you're junior. And then we'll decide what is it that you're going to do. So I took the test, and as luck will have it, I have the largest success story because I was the largest grade, even more than the seniors of that year, which was really interesting because the principal of school never told my mother. And so mommy says, well, at this stage of the game, I think you're even more prepared to go to college. I said, mommy, I'm not going. So she was not very happy with me.
Antonia's mother ended up convincing her to go to college at age 15. In the early 60s, Antonia was one of five women studying medicine at her university.
When you're a few, in my generation, the women were not helping women. We were just like a group of people trying to get to the top. And when we got there, it was very hard to be able to get into anything else. And it's almost a little bit now like the Fortune 500. Once they get there, it's very hard unless you retire, you expire, or your age takes you out of the competition. And so it's always like you're jumping some fence to get somewhere. And so my life has always been like that. Then I went into medical school, I finished, and then I was able to, in the naval base in Puerto Rico, I met the officer in charge of medicine, and eventually we married. And it was really interesting because he had just finished a full internship in surgery. So I wanted to be a surgeon. And he says, let's put it this way. Do you want to be a married pediatrician or a single surgeon? Of course, I am a pediatrician. But then God comes and makes me the Surgeon General of the United States, which I have not let him forget.
Soon after Antonia married, she left with her husband to the United States to complete her studies in Michigan and Washington, D.C. After graduating, Antonia worked as a pediatrician for a few years. She then considered joining the U.S. Navy, but was discouraged by a male recruiter.
Interesting enough, the guy who came to interview me was a captain, and he proceeded to put his feet on the desk and read the newspaper while I am in front of him. And then when he had the desire, he moved the newspaper and told me, "Did you hear? We are looking for a few good men." And proceeded to read.
Instead, Antonia decided to sign on to the U.S. Public Health Service. She joined the National Institutes of Health while simultaneously earning a master's in public health at Johns Hopkins University.
There was a class that says government and health. And I said, I learned that government controls my health, controls my well-being. And all of a sudden, I got very interested in public health because I realized that there are people in silence governing your life that are helping you to be better. And all of a sudden, I decided I better be one of those if I want to be successful. I don't hang a diploma behind my desk unless I feel very proud of it. And so I said, I'm going to be now a doctor in public health.
Antonia was eventually promoted as deputy director of the National Institute of Child Health and Human Development. But despite her achievements, she continued to face scrutiny, even from other women.
When I was the executive secretary at the NIH, culturally, Hispanic women are very caring. So I asked the chairman, can I get you a cup of coffee or can I get you a cup of tea? And the first women dean of the University of Boston is there. And she says to me, you will never get anywhere.
I spoke to Nicole Mason to better understand why women in leadership are so often judged so harshly. Nicole is the president and CEO of the Institute for Women's Policy Research, an economic think tank focused on women's economic security and influence in society.
I think women leaders, women of color leaders, they have a higher threshold in terms of proving themselves as leaders. They face a lot more scrutiny. We can just look at Hillary Clinton in 2008 and also Hillary Clinton in 2016. These are textbook examples of women's leadership not be taken seriously, being scrutinized, overly scrutinized, especially in 2016 when Hillary Clinton was head and shoulders above the Republican candidate, but still faced this Herculean effort to electability. And a lot of it centered around, you know, very sexist stereotypes about women's leadership. And that is really hard for anyone to, you know, navigate on a national stage. And, you know, I think we need to take those things as instructive because women leaders, once they're in the public eye or put themselves out there, face an enormous amount of scrutiny, abuse, you know, verbal attacks that meant that their male counterparts do not experience seeking the same office. And, you know, we have to ask ourselves, why is that? And then the other thing I want to say, which is unpopular opinion, but the truth of the matter is that some women don't support women leaders. So there's like internalized sexism happening here. And we saw this in 2016 with Hillary Clinton and particularly white women, where 50% of white women voted for Donald Trump. And, you know, people can say that those were Republican women who were going to vote for the Republican candidate, regardless of who they were. But the other thing is that what's also true is they may have not embraced the idea of a woman as the leader of the United States. And both those things can be true.
According to the United Nations, as of 2021, there are only 26 women serving as heads of states and or government. Globally, only 21% of government ministers were women, with only 14 countries having achieved 50% or more of women in cabinets. At the current rate, gender equality in the highest positions of power will not be reached for another 130 years.
Sometimes the U.S. holds itself out as a model of democracy and women's progress, but that's actually just not true. On many indicators of social progress and well-being, the United States ranks is very mid or low. And political participation is one of those indicators where the U.S. is woefully behind. just when we think about the representation of women in elected office at the federal and at the state level, and then the hard time we have electing women to the highest office of the land, which is the presidency. In my opinion, it's not for lack of desire or ambition for women. It's the structural and systemic and cultural barriers that prevent women from, you know, breaking through in significant ways, especially in relationship to political participation.
In the United States, women make up only 28% of Congress at large. Women of color are even more disadvantaged, making up only 10% of the total members of Congress and 9% of total state legislators. And we have never had a female as president or head of government.
In 2016, when Trump was elected, we saw a bump in the number of women elected officials. During the midterm, it was the most women elected to political office in the history of the U.S. And then we obviously saw the election of, you know, Kamala Harris as the vice president, which is the highest office that we've seen a woman hold in the United States. But I temper my enthusiasm for some of those gains with the reality and the fact of the matter that we haven't elected a woman to the highest office of the land, which is the presidency, and that women are woefully underrepresented in Congress and in many states in the state legislatures. So, and if we keep at this pace, we won't see significant change in those numbers for decades.
I asked Nicole what barriers are keeping women from reaching leadership roles in government.
Well, there are a few things. So first, I think we cannot not talk about gender norms and stereotypes and culture, who we understand to be capable of leading and what our leaders look like. And unfortunately, in the U.S., we have a very male-centered leadership model. At all levels, whether we think about corporate or we think about politics, it's a very male-centered model, and white male-centered, I want to be very clear. And so anybody that deviates from that has trouble getting elected, their electability, and they face a significant number of barriers, including both racism and sexism. You know, we have to honestly talk about those things and those barriers, and we saw it, you know, with VP Harris, and we saw with Hillary Clinton, and a number of women seeking political office. Like, that's a clear barrier. The other thing I would say is that money is also a barrier. I think the threshold is a little bit different from at the state level and local level. But at the federal level, money and resources is a significant barrier. So campaign finance reform is also really important. And lowering barriers for entry. I mean, even, you know, childcare, you know, having to manage your childcare responsibilities, your care responsibilities, and also running for political office. You know, there are some states where you can expense childcare or childcare is covered as a part of your campaign expense. But like, how long did it take for that to happen or for that to be a part of the conversation? I remember watching the last Democratic primary, which there were several women running, and not one of them talked about being a mom. And all of them were moms. And so when they entered the stage, I believe it was a perception that they had to leave part of themselves behind or off the stage in order to be taken seriously or be seen as a credible leader. I think some of the things that we say is that, you know, women don't want to run for office, or they just, you know, tell them they can run. And I think that's true, but that's not the biggest of our barriers when it comes to women's political participation and engagement.
Why is it important for women and women of color specifically to be involved in politics and in public service?
You know, people always ask me, you know, they're like, why? You know, it seems like a mystery. They say, well, why haven't women ascended to the presidency? Or why aren't we getting the policies that we say that matter to us? And it, like, it's some mystery. And then I always say, well, you just have to look at the makeup of our Congress to understand why women's progress has stalled, or the challenges we have around women's reproductive health, why we don't have a better childcare infrastructure in the U.S. And that's because women are not present. And we know that when women hold office, when women are elected at the, you know, in decision-making positions, policies shift and policies change and policies reflect the needs of the people in a real way. And when women are not there, when women of color are not there, when we don't have a diverse representation, we see what happens. We see the kind of policies that come out on the other end. And right now, I mean, we can look at attacks on women's reproductive health, you know, Build Back Better in the American Families Plan. You know, I think if women had been 50% or more, we'd be in a different place.
As Nicole notes, if we don't have more women and women of color in leadership, our policies won't address their needs. In 1989, Antonia was nominated by then President George Bush to become the U.S. Surgeon General. The Surgeon General is a director of the U.S. Public Health Service and the administration's spokesperson on health issues. Antonia was the 14th person to hold the job, but the first female and the first minority. In her time as Surgeon General, Antonia focused on providing better healthcare services for America's minorities, women, and children. She raised awareness around domestic violence, a largely unaddressed topic at the time.
There was never a law strong enough to be able to recognize the rights of women. So I became very much involved into domestic violence and I spoke everywhere that I could. But interestingly enough, I was not able to do what I always wanted until the ambassador of the United States to the Dominican Republic told me that they were number 19 in the world with respect to domestic violence. Interesting enough, the law was weak. The shelters for women in the Dominican Republic only opened from Monday to Friday from 8 to 5. So if you want to appoint you after 6 o'clock and all over the weekends, great. But more than anything, the law established that when you accuse the man, you have to bring him to court. And most of the time, they never return because they got killed. So we changed the law, changed the perception, and gave the woman a voice. And so at that moment, I felt we had accomplished a lot. And today, domestic violence is everywhere, but the courts are paying much more attention to it, and the women are free to speak.
Antonia became an example and a role model to other women pursuing careers in the public sector.
Mentoring is crucial at every level of your life, even when you're at the top. And I find that the lack of role models in our life keeps us out of the game. And in that sense, always 31% of women graduate from the top universities and 31% of women stay home, take care of children, because society judges me as you take care of your pride rather than taking care of your family, rather than telling me you can do both. You absolutely can do both. And with a good husband, you absolutely can do both. So that message is never out there. Education with a peer, with a role model that tells me it's okay to be, and one day you will make, and they tell me the steps how to get there.
Having female mentorship and role models in leadership is definitely important, but we must also challenge the patriarchal culture that undermines women. I asked Nicole what she believes we can do as a society to start taking women's leadership more seriously.
We have to be really honest and be willing to have the brave conversations about the ways in which we've treated women leaders, historically and present day, and to call it out when we see it, when we see the bad treatment happening, when we see the double standard, when we see women leaders being treated differently than their male counterparts. And also holding male leaders accountable, because I have to say, male leaders rely on the cultural gender stereotypes about women's leadership to advance their own leadership. And so we also need to have that conversation as well. And when Hillary ran in 2008, she experienced sexism. And then in 2016, we thought like, okay, it can't be the same. It was so horrible then. And then you see some of the same tropes about women's leaderships being trotted out. So I do think that we just need to really have very honest conversations in the public sphere. Like, it doesn't need to be a closed door conversation. And then also holding the people who shape media and the narratives around women leadership to account. The most powerful thing that I remember seeing was Hillary Clinton being interviewed by, you know, male reporters and even some women reporters, and some of the questions that they were asking, some of them were really cringeworthy. but there's no accountability. And so I think accountability, honest conversations, and being willing to say, not on my watch, not again, I think is really important. And also believing women when they tell you about their experiences running for office and how people are treating them as leaders. We need to believe them. And I think the last thing I'll say is making it easier for women to run. Yes, you can tell women you can run for office, but if you don't clear the barriers that allow them to do that, it's like when you say, if you're sick and someone says, do you need anything? Instead of saying, I can get you some chicken noodle soup. Those are two different things.
I asked Nicole what we can do to break down some of the structural barriers keeping women from leadership.
I just don't think we have the answers, but I do believe that there's an urgency to figuring this out because, one, our democracy is in peril. Our rights are being stripped right from under us. And I do feel like historically, this is a moment where we need to be really thinking about new strategies and new ways of engagement. Like, for example, you know, you can get more women to run for office, right? There's so many organizations, at least three that I'm aware of, that train women to run for political office. And so you can have the pipeline, but if the structural and institutional barriers exist, whether it's, you know, gerrymandering, redistricting, voter intimidation, and you have all these other tactics, it's going to clog up the pipeline. Those women are not going to be able to get through. You know, in my opinion, if I'm really going to give a moonshot around this, I do think that we need to have proportionate representation. It doesn't make sense that women are 50% of the population and less than that in terms of political representation at the federal, state, and local levels. And that same thing is true for women and people of color. I think that the democracy should be representative of the people. We need to change the laws, the legislation, the constitution, whatever we need to do to make that the truth. And other than that, I don't really see it changing on its own, like organically. These are not issues that, if left on their own, would figure themselves out.
We still have a long way to go to achieve gender equality in government. But women like Antonia remind us that it is possible to do so. What do you hope people will gain from listening to your story, your accomplishments, the road you took to get here, the perseverance you displayed along the way? What are your hopes of someone listening to this? What could their takeaways be?
Nothing is impossible. Even when I was sick in hospitals 2 weeks every summer until my age of 18, never anything was impossible. Use everything that makes you fall down for you to be able to grow up. And I find that you have to have education. Without it, you cannot make it. Find a mentor, somebody that believes in you, and go out there and follow them, shadow them. Remember, when you walk to the top, don't forget there is somebody out there that you have to help. Even in the middle of failure, there's a lot of successes. Don't pay attention to the failures. Just get up and go at it. But every time you build, you're responsible for one person to go up with you. And it might be in the most obscure part of the land. They will search for you. They will ask for mentorship. And your responsibility is to make their lives better because you existed.
Policy and governance shapes the world in which we live. Having women's voices around the decision-making table in government is critical. On our podcast, we aim to educate and inspire you to take action. There are many ways to do that. Here are just a few suggestions. First, if you're a young woman, namely a young woman of color, consider running for office or nominating yourself for a leadership position in government. Your voice matters. Second, support women in government. Read about their work, donate to their campaigns, and share their stories. And third, if you see unfair treatment of women in leadership positions, speak out. If you'd like to hear more empowering stories from Finding Humanity or to learn more about this episode, visit our website at findinghumanitypodcast.com. Please subscribe, rate, and review the podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. Your ratings and reviews help Finding Humanity reach new audiences. So we thank you for your support. In our podcast, we cover pressing and at times controversial social and political issues. The views and opinions expressed are those of the interviewees and do not reflect the positions or opinions of the producers or any affiliated organizations. Finding Humanity is a joint production of the Humanity Lab Foundation and Human Group Media. Our co-executive producers are Camille Lorente and Hazami Bermada. Associate producers are Fernanda Ollegas and Tani Jirapaprasok. Policy and background research by Carolina Mindica and Tani Jirapaprasok. Mixing, editing, and music by Maverick Aquino. For this episode, I'd like to thank Dr. Antonio Novello and Nicole Mason. I'm your host, Hazami Bermada. Thank you for listening, and I look forward to seeing you again on the next episode.